Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
Thank you, Dave Solomon, and away we go on this beautiful day in Baltimore, Maryland. Hopefully wherever you are, maybe the sun is shining, maybe it's a little bit dark outside, maybe it's full-blown night. This show goes all over the world, and aren't we glad? 102,000 folks strong have listened to the show. Yes. Crazy. Woo! Just checked even more, and there's considerably more than 102,000 as of this morning. So I'm really grateful and very excited about this year. January has been eye-opening in the way of music possibilities and what we can do to enhance the growth of jazz, etc. Be listening, because there's going to be some revelations here that are going to take some folks aback in the best way. We're doing our best. This is the honest-to-goodness truth about making sure that everybody gets a piece of that pie. I love it. Professor Ron Kearns joins us next hour on Hybrid Jazz, and this is going to be a great reunion. Ron's got a big event coming up, and we're going to talk about that and Quiet Nights, his tribute to jazz samba in the U.S. But right now we're going to start off with something classic from 1962, the Art Farmer Benny Golson Jazz Tet. This is Space Station from another get-together on Hybrid Jazz. Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
again. Life to death, weak to strength. Cash a check, change your sex. Day to night, dark to light. Hard to fall, on to off. Push to shove, hate to love. In and out, it's all about transformation. Wet to dry, born to die. Yin to yang, pleasure or pain. Good to bad, crazy or sane. Hey, you make the rules, you got to play the game. Kiss the glove, lose the win. You live a life of sin, then you're born again. Trash to art, heart to heart.
From Terry Lynn Carrington's 2011 award-winning Mosaic Project. Nona Hendricks. When I see that name, I just come alive. You know why? Because in this day and age, here it is, January 16th, 2014, when we're doing this particular cast, if you will, this online radio cast, to be black, bold, beautiful, brave, bisexual, and absolutely speak all of who you are into existence. I crave people like that, especially when combined with all of that, you are so positive and want to make things so much better for other people who have been continually underserved. And this is a woman who's going to be my fellow Libra sister, 70 this October. I am just so psyched because Nona Hendricks is going to be part of a beautiful little situation at Burke's Jazz. You heard Najee say several days ago that he gets weary of seeing the same old acts at some of these festivals. And to a degree, that's true at Burke's Jazz this year, as has been the case. But I will say that they go out of the box sometimes. And when they do, it's happening. So there will be a particular event called Sly Reimagined, as in Sly Stone. So, Nona Hendricks will be involved, as will Karen Briggs. Karen Briggs, the astounding violinist, will be tonight in Bethesda at the Blues and Jazz Club there in the heart of the city with Lau Tizer, who was with us the other day. So it's going to be Karen Briggs and Nona Hendricks, Andy Snitzer, and more. Can you imagine this? Because everybody who's going to be part of this will be a Sly Stone fan. So you can imagine the passion on that stage. Love Nona Hendricks. Just read something about her today that the longtime friend and manager of Dusty Springfield, who, gosh, so many of us revered when we were youngins, Dusty Springfield was the bomb. Oh, back in the day when she came out in the 60s with I Only Want to Be With You and was hanging with the Beatles. She had another hit with The Look of Love, the Burt Bacharach, Hal David song. So many songs. Son of a Preacher Man. Well, as it turns out, Dusty and Vicky, her manager, had a longtime friendship. They were both, and back in that day, you couldn't talk about being gay, but they both were, and they remained platonically involved with one another. And then Vicky got involved with Nona Hendricks. So I'm so immersed in the musical history and then in the relationships that Nona had along the way, because Vicky was also part and parcel the managerial system for LaBelle with Patti LaBelle back in the day. So it's like we're all tied together by this thin little fabulous thread, and every time you hear a story, it ties into somebody else who you know. I just love it. There's Nona Hendricks. Can you tell I appreciate her? Greg Adams, Burma Road from 1995, his debut as leader post his association with Tower of Power. That shakuhachi flute makes that song, doesn't it? Woo-hoo! Hidden Agenda was the name of the CD. Smooth Operator was on this, by the way. And Greg Adams just celebrated the birthday of his lovely wife, Andrea. And hopefully there will be some gigs in the Mid-Atlantic or East Coast this year. If you get a chance to see East Bay Soul with Greg as leader, please go. It will be the time of your life, one of the most memorable concerts ever. We started off with Art Farmer and the Benny Golson Jazz Sextet. Got to tell you a little bit about this. Ron Kearns coming up next hour. I'm excited about my buddy being here. This particular assembly of talent was Golson's idea. There were many quintets at that time, 1962, but not sextets, and Benny wanted to hear that extra instrument. So on this particular another get-together LP, That's what it was called, Space Station, the name of the tune. There was on trombone Grishan Mancor, and then there was trumpet and flugelhorn provided by Art Farmer. Of course, Benny Golson on sax, who did the arranging and composing, and then Art did a lot of the soloing. And then there was Harold Mayburn on piano, Herbie Lewis on bass, and Roy McCurdy on drums. They made their first public appearance as the Sextet, which was, you know, not a lot happening like that around that time in D.C. in 1962. They did their run in 1959, and then they lasted until... Oh, actually, they did their first public appearance in D.C. in 1959. They lasted till 62, and then 20 years later, Benny and Art reformed the group. Very interesting personnel going back and forth, the different amalgams of that beautiful idea from Benny, who will be, as a matter of fact, 85 on the 25th of January. He's also going to be at the Mid-Atlantic Jazz Festival, so stand by for news about that. Yeah. I'm really excited about today. There's a lot to get done. A lot has been done. The Tizer concert tonight, and Ron Kearns talking about another event at Bethesda Blues and Jazz, who will be here next hour. Let's get to more music, though, shall we? Our friend Carl Stanley, who has been on the show, as has been Dwight Sills. They got together for this Beautiful Thing CD from 2 years ago. You Make Me La La. That's the name of the song on Hybrid Jazz. Thank you. David Pack with Ambrosia from 1980. From 180. Yes. The name of the CD. Do you remember? Biggest Part of Me. What's your favorite part of that song? Is it like Yours Truly, Ain't Life Grand? Woo! I just feel it every time he sings that. There's something very special about David Pack, and I'm so happy because it looks like he is getting a new lease on his career and is moving forward strongly in 2014. He has had a Facebook friends page, but he's encouraging everybody to get off and get on board the David Pack music page on Facebook. I'm excited because, first of all, he's got an Indiegogo campaign project with his good friend. And then I see that he's going to be with Jim Peterik at the World Stage in Chicago on the 18th with Mike Reno of Loverboy and others from that generation. Jim Peterik, of course, the amazing composer and producer. When Lisa McLowry has been on the show, she's always talking about the collaborations between she and Jim. And David and he are pretty tight, so this is really very cool. David's, as a matter of fact, active in the correspondence now on the Facebook page. I think that his wife had been taking on those chores for a while, but David is real involved with his church, and I think that he saw, like many of us did in 2013, that our contemporaries, our peers, were leaving us quickly. So he wants to make sure that he lives life to the fullest and gets on tour and gets seen and gets more music out. I'm very encouraged by this. We also heard Ahmad Jamal, 83 years young. Saturday morning. The name of the CD that came out in 2013, just an amazing project, seriously. To hear the fluidity from start to finish of this project is so monumental. An amazing reputation, and I'm telling you, he is active. I don't know how he's going to do this, but there it is. Ireland, London, Brussels, Lucerne, Geneva. Back to the USA in February. He's on tour now, ladies and gentlemen. Ahmad Jamal on that very inspirational keyboard that he has thrilled us with for so long. And on this particular album, Reginald Veal on bass and former Weather Report percussionist Manola Bedrina. Just having the joyful time of their lives. If you go to ahmadjamal.net, I think it is. I think. Wait, let me double check that for you because we've got little time. Ron Kearns is coming up with us. And look, we had a little conversation, Ron and I, doing private messages on Facebook. It's a good doggone thing that you can't see these conversations. Oh, my. Yes, ahmadjamal.net. And what else did we hear? Oh, my gosh, Carl Stanley. From his CD, A Beautiful Thing from 2012, the name of the song is You Make Me La La, fill in your own blanks, Dwight Sills with him. Dwight's on a cruise right now, you know which one. Carl Stanley's been doing his thing with Roy Ayers and Peter White and Jeff Lorber, and he's always busy in the UK where he still calls home. London is his town, and on this particular CD, by the way, if you didn't know about it, our good friend Gianna Welling and Ollie Silk join Dwight Sills for some thrills, and that rhymes, we know. Let's get a few more pieces of music together. I wanted to play this because this is just so inspired. Love Jerry Allen's work anyway, and you know that this show is always going to be a bugaboo about female artists who are so worthy to play. Jerry Allen had a new release in 2013, as well as Ahmad Jamal, again on the keyboard, just an amazing composer and wonderful reputation, so able to get folks together and do what she wants, which is no small feat because she is a very unique being. And you'll hear this right now from Grand River Crossings, Motown and Motor City Inspirations. This is Jerry Allen with her take on an inspiration from Stevie Wonder, That Girl. This is Hybrid Jazz. Mark of a master right there. Woohoo! Lou Bassa from Quiet Nights, came out last year, and it's still creating such a buzz. You have no idea how respected this man is in the region. If you're in the region, you already know, because there's something that is real pivotal in the city of Baltimore, and it has had repercussions for years. Anytime you go to a jam or a collection of jazz folks, people who remember what it was like to have had this astounding jazz education in the city, they always talk about Frederick Douglass and the Music Careers Program. Whew! So many amazing people have sprung forth from the loins, which is what I said on the teaser for this gentleman. Why I use that phraseology, I have no idea. But the bottom line is that there are so many talented people that have come from this region and nurturing those folks along to a very large degree has been this man, saxophonist, teacher, band leader, writer, author. I could go on, and I will, because he'll let me do that. This is my professor, if you would please make welcome, Ron Kearns. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Trish. How are you?
I'm better now that I hear your gilded throat.
Whoa. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm telling you, you do not know, or maybe you do, but you were raised, Ron, to have a very strong sense of what it's like to have a fabulous reputation. So you and I are about the same age, and I know that even if we weren't, just because of the kind of person that you are, you would recognize this. But do you have any idea of how wonderful a reputation you do have?
Well, you know, the reputation that I have really lies with the talented young people that I taught, because had they not gone on to do so well and follow some of the directions that we as faculty members at Douglass put into them, none of us would have had any kind of reputation. None of us would have had any kind of credibility, any kind of name. And so in order to get any kind of accolades or any kind of attention as an educator, the educated have to be the ones that carry forth whatever your legacy is and whatever your name is.
Mm. Well, that's a humble man's reply, and I appreciate that. but there has to be a large something to be said about the care and feeding of this talent, because, you know, if in your education, it speaks volumes in case anyone does not know. And I have to ask about these circumstances, because there's a lot of education involved here, including a master's at Catholic University and then Knoxville. But you also went from high school to the University of East Africa. How did that come to be? I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because the American Institute for Foreign Study was trying to start a program with the United States and Africa, and they chose the University of East Africa as their initial contact and their thing going into there. And so they came along and went to different schools around the country trying to get young people to go. And of course, African-American young people were very interested at that time, because everything was going Afrocentric and everyone was interested in finding out about the motherland and finding out what was going on. And and my parents decided that they wanted that to be part of my overall education, that they wanted me to be able to go back and see the roots and find out what a strong history and heritage I came from. And so my father especially was instrumental in getting it done. And of course, as I went over there and found out all the treasures and riches that were there, it was just a life-changing event for me.
Oh, I'll bet. Woo! And I have to say this about your parents, how wonderful that they were so supportive of so many endeavors that you undertook, because a lot of parents are not that way, and you always speak so glowingly of your dad, and I know that your mom just within the past few months has passed away. And I know, you know, Ron, you and I have talked about that because of my mom who left us in 2009 at the age of 98. Your mom lived a long life.
Whew. Yes, yes.
And I know you
and
miss her.
And she put a lot into that. She put a lot into that long life.
Yes, she
in fact,
did.
She was my model as a teaching educator, because when she died, I received on Facebook notifications from students that had taken had been taught by her in kindergarten and first grade. Now these are people now in their 50s and 60s, and they're contacting
yeah.
me, letting me know what kind of an effect my mom had on them. And
wow.
that speaks volumes about education, and it showed why I did what I did and why I want to be what I want to be. And I think the thing that really makes certain teachers stand out from other teachers is that they have a passion for two things. They have a passion for passing things along to students, and they have a passion for whatever subject matter they happen to be teaching and whatever their responsibilities are. They don't just do it just to say something that they're doing. And obviously, in most cases, it's not because of any kind of monetary gain. So as I used to tell my kids all the time, passion for music is contagious. And the other thing that helped me was that my kids would always see that whatever free time I had, I was always grabbing my horn trying to practice, because as a teacher, you don't have a lot of time to be able to do what a lot of other musicians do, and that's to have plenty of time to practice. So I had to grab whatever practice time I could between classes and during lunch and before school and after school. And my kids noticed that even though I was teaching, I was not letting that personal development side fall along the wayside.
Well, you know, one wonders, and you don't have to wonder too much, because part of your particular career scenario is that you did become a teacher. But how is it that you became such an astute saxophonist? Because what kinds of atmosphere, was it varied? Was your father or mother or both strict about what you heard? What was it that inspired you to be a saxophonist?
Well, it's very interesting. There are a couple of things. My mother had music all over the house. She had all kinds of music. So I had a very eclectic development as far as listening, from country western to pure classical. But my jazz side and the saxophone side actually came from my brother. My older brother, who was 8 years older than I am, traveled all over the country, and he had worked during the summers in San Francisco and in Chicago. And when he was in school and in graduate school, he was right outside of New York. And he brought all these recordings home. And when I was about 13, he brought jazz samba into the house. And I fell in love with Stan Getz sound. And
mm-hmm.
then the next thing he did was he brought in Dave Brubeck, Take Five. And I loved Paul Desmond sound. And so it became all about the sound. And the saxophone had such a pure, clean, and beautiful sound to me that I decided that's what I wanted to do. Plus, my brother was a trumpet player, and I didn't want to follow him. I didn't want to hear, you know, well, your brother could do this, your brother could do that. So I knew trumpet was not going to be the instrument that I wanted to go into. And I had a cousin by the name of Harold Alexander, known as Jazz Bo. And Harold was in a group with Don Pullen and some other people and other really great musicians. And he would come through, and I would hear him play, and I would see him play. And it was just fascinating. Just the saxophone just kind of grabbed me rather than me grabbing it.
Yeah, how many times have we heard that through the years? It's not something that you choose. It chooses you. So
yes.
Actually, that was a pretty organic way for you to get involved. Yeah, that's the key element. At the age of 13, you fell in love with jazz samba. So that would stand to reason why you're so doggone excited about this upcoming concert at Bethesda Blues and Jazz. Woohoo! Got to ask
exactly.
about that.
Yeah, well, that is also why Quiet Nights came into reality as a recording. Excuse me. It was the first time I recorded as a quartet, because I usually always have a front man, and one of my favorite front men will be joining me at Bethesda Blues and Jazz. And that's Michael Thomas. Michael
yeah,
is an amazing trumpeter. And we were talking the other night about the fact that the one thing that, that is always interesting and an interesting component of my groups is that everybody in my groups has a sound that they have developed that is a really great sound to hear. But then we get really organic in the fact that all of our sounds contribute to a group sound that is, in a lot of ways, a very unique sound, because for us, it really is all about sound. After a certain level of professionals, you expect certain proficiencies to be there, technical proficiencies. But
sure.
The one thing in my mind as a producer and as a performer that separates musicians is their sound. I don't want to put on a record and hear every saxophone player sound exactly the same or every trumpet player sound exactly the same. And so because of that, for me, sound is everything. And so given that, melody is a very important aspect for me. And the music of Antonio Carlos Jobim is so very melodic and so sensuous that you can't help but be captivated by it. And
oh,
so the
yes.
show that we're doing, the show that we're doing is a show of the music of Jobim and the music of Brazil. We're doing bossas and bossa novas, and some things that people have heard, like Girl from Ipanema and One Note Samba, but then other things that have been embraced by jazzers, like Ricardo Bossa Nova and some other things that some people will really like, but things that will always, I don't care whether you're a jazz lover or just a casual music listener, these things will always get two things out of you, a head bob and a foot tap. and so anybody, whether they love jazz, like jazz or anything, if they came to the show, they would immediately be captivated by the beauty of the melodies and by the sound that these guys create when they play.
Well, honestly, you told me about this earlier because you and I go back and forth on Facebook quite a bit, just to get a sense of who will be there. And all of these cats that you're playing with love jazz so much. And that's the big difference, Ron, when you can have a formidable group, what's the word that's usually used for marriage, but equally yoked, when you find a similar feeling, a simpatico among musicians who are trying to accomplish the same thing as you, that means everything. You don't have to worry about the technical proficiency of the people that you're on stage with. All you have to concern yourself with is the vibe, the folks from the audience feeding you the love that you know that you're going to get anyway, but how much passion are they bringing to the table for the kind of
exactly.
music that you're playing? And, man, do you ever have a stellar group.
Yeah, I try to do that. You know, one of the things as a producer, one of the things that I feel is that when you put a group together, you want it to be a group that can communicate with one another and can share the same passion. And that passion and that communication will come across when you put on a recording. And one of the differences between a lot of the older recordings and a lot of the current recordings also is that if you listen, you can tell when you have a group of highly proficient players playing together, it's a very good recording. But when you hear a group that has connected on that level that we want to connect on in jazz, it just jumps out of the
yes.
box for you, and you can hear immediately the difference. And it's not saying that one is better than the other. It's more so one touches you more than the other, because it really depends on what you're looking for.
Yes, and I have to say, in regard to Quiet Nights, that you had one of the more astounding drummers that I know of in this region, certainly. But I've noticed, you know, when folks come in to Blues Alley, especially if they're coming from the West Coast or if they're coming abroad, you know, Ron, I don't have to tell you this, a lot of the time they get the scuttlebutt about Mark Prince. So
yes,
he
call.
Was, Yes, first call. And he just gets it. He's a young man, and he is so well-versed in different kinds of styles. He loves jazz, and he always wants to make you, whoever he is playing for, make you shine. He's a beauty.
Yes. Yes. Well, it goes back to the same kind of thing, you know, sound. There are drummers, and there are bangers. And drummers do what you just described, and the better drummers do it at a higher level. Then there are those who just want to kind of tap something out, and they want to get flashy, and they want to go, and you know, people will leave the show, and they'll, man, that drummer was doing this, that drummer was doing that. The best shows you can go to are the shows where you don't hear anybody say anything about how good the bass player was or how good the drummer was, because then you know, as a musician especially, that drummer or that bass player was absolutely great because they did their job so very well.
Mm.
Nobody paid attention to what they were doing. They created such a bond in the group and made the group become the instrument rather than individual parts. That's the thing that happens. And every bass player I've ever recorded with or I've ever worked with and every drummer that I've ever worked with does that. And Mark Prince is one of those, as you said, who does it at a level that a whole lot of folk aspire to. And, in fact, because of that, he won't be on the date with me on the 26th because NAMM is having their convention in California the same time. The company that he endorses with, is flying him out because they want everybody at NAMM to know he's one of theirs.
gotcha. Makes perfect sense.
exactly. And so this is the first time that we've booked something that he was going to be on that got changed. I mean, you know, because he's always there. That's the other thing that you love about the greats. When they are available and when they are going to be with you, they're with you. And see, the thing about it with Mark, and the reason that Mark is so important to me is I had a drummer for years that was the only drummer that I recorded with, the only drummer I played with, by the name of Mike Smith. And Mike was one of those. And the first time I heard Mike was when I was in college, and he was the drummer with Roberta Flack. And they were playing at this place called Mr. Henry's in Southeast D.C.
Yes.
And I went to the show, and I said, boy, I wish I could play with a guy like that one day. And then as it turned out, I did a lot of recordings with him, and I produced a lot of recordings with him as the drummer, and then I did a lot of shows with him. In fact, he was my only drummer for about 15 years.
Oh, my goodness, that's a long time.
And when he passed, you know, I was in the position where I had to try to find a drummer, and I'd never had to do that. So when I had to do that, you know, the number of drummers that I chose had to match up in my mind with what Mike brought to the table, as well as being part of that family thing you're talking about, where the vibe is just right. You know immediately when they play that first song with you whether the vibe is going to be the vibe that you want or not. And that's the case with Mark always. But on this particular date, we're going to have Robert Shahid, who when I played for the first time, you know, I noticed was the same kind of drummer, same kind of guy, you know, that was not there to do anything other than to bring the most out of the music he could bring. And so when I found out that Mark couldn't do it, there were only two drummers that came to mind for this particular style that we're doing, and Robert was the first one that got the call for that.
You know, I'll say this about Robert Shahid. I really like him so much, and I'm coming to know him in a different way because now, him having been in place, now I'm one of the new board of directors, board members on the Baltimore Jazz Alliance Committee. So coming to know Robert in a different way, and I have known him for a few years, he is one of those guys. He's very, very rare. He takes great delight in being able to be part of your assembly. He is never without a smile. He firmly believed.
That's what I was going to say. You know, and the thing about this, that smile comes through his playing. I mean,
yes.
You know, it goes back to what we talked about earlier. It's about that passion. You can see. And I used to joke around when we played until a club owner got nervous when he heard me say it, so I stopped saying it. But I used to have what I call was a money back guarantee. If the audience didn't see us having fun on stage, they could get their money back.
Whoa.
And of course, after the first song, you know, I would come back and say, well, you know, you won't be getting your money back because obviously we had some fun. We had some fun on stage. And of course, he does.
Mm.
Yes, yes. And everybody in the group does. And so that was the reason, one of the reasons why he was brought in. Because as I said, it's for me, it's not about, you know, who plays this and who plays that and all that. I mean, that is a major part of it. But the issue is, how will this fit with every other part? And what will this part do to make the whole better? And so that's the mentality that goes with me for choosing a group for my own performances or choosing a group for recording I'm producing if there's someone who needs a group put together for a recording.
And that is quite a different kind of decision-making process because, you know, this seems almost superficial. I don't think it is for you, Ron, and I'll say this because it certainly goes back to Robert Shahid and to Michael Thomas. The three of you are cut from a very similar cloth in that you believe that the music is so important that you dress accordingly. So
Right. That
needs to get stated, and it's a different scenario when you're wearing the producer hat because you cannot control what somebody wears to a recording session, but for something that is your show, to have an audience come in to see that you have dressed up in order to play, it casts an elegant tone on what expectations are. When somebody is dressed rather elegantly, you think to yourself, oh, this is a cut above a regular show.
That was always the impression I got when I went out. I loved seeing those stately gentlemen step on stage and look like they did, groups like the Modern Jazz Quartet and others who came out, and they were what we used to call clean as the Board of Health. And you have to include in that you're talking about, and we talk about people that play that I play with and work with all the time, Kent Miller. I mean, Kent Miller, you know, we joke, all of us joke about the dress code because all the guys in my group pretty much know the way I like to dress on stage, and so there's never a question as to, you know, what are we going to wear, how are we going to be dressed. Everybody comes in clean as a steamed chitlin on Sunday.
I love that. I can't use it with as much success as you, but
there you go.
Yeah, and that really does say a lot. It people want a night out, and this is going to be on Sunday, your Bethesda Blues and Jazz extravaganza. So when you come on Sunday, especially, a lot of folks will have been in church, or they will have gone to a nice lunch or dinner at BB&J, and they want to know that there's going to be something that is akin to their Sunday experience waiting for them.
Right. And the other thing is I always tell people, because of a lot of the venues that we play, there are a lot of people that pay a lot of good money, and this is a very special night out. And some guy who's wanting to impress some young lady or some husband who's finally getting a nice date night with his wife,
yes,
and he's going to be spending some money and wants to be able to come out and enjoy. And so we try to make sure that the kind of fun we're having on stage gets transmitted through the music and through our actions to the audience, so that when you come to one of my shows, I can't guarantee you that you're going to love everything we do, but I can guarantee you that you're going to love enough of what we do to have a good time. And that's because, once again, we enjoy the music and we enjoy performing for people. And so we put as much of ourselves into the show as we can possibly put into it without taking away from the music. I mean, you know, we're not going to be comedians on stage. We're not going to be clowns on stage. We're going to uphold the integrity of the music. But we're also going to make sure that the joy that we're getting out of the music, we can pass on to the audience.
You'll no doubt do that, and there's going to be a large memory factor here because, you know, those of us who are our age, Ron, remember that this beautiful sound came from Brazil, and we were all captivated. We were very young at the time, but we remember. If you were really blessed, you heard that jazz samba sound on your AM radio maybe back in the day. And for those of us to recall that via a 50-year tribute, as it were, to jazz samba, that's a big deal because some of those memories are so acute for us and some of them will never leave. That to go back in time to be transported, oh, geez, we owe you some right. thanks because we need to be transported, okay?
Well, I tell you, you know, the funny thing about it, and show how this recording was so important in my life. My junior high school band director, who was one of the coolest guys I'd ever seen, he was always clean, and he played tenor saxophone. And when he got the job at our junior high school, he decided to bring his group in and perform for the school. And one of the songs that he performed was Girl from Ipanema. Mm. And another was Desafinado. And both of those are going to be performed on the 26th. But hearing him do it, after having listened to the recording of Stan Getz and Charlie Bird doing it, it kind of sealed it for me. It let me know, okay, you know, this is just one of those things that come from the great cosmic beyond. Okay, this is it, son. Listen to it. Here's a guy you are looking at and want to be like, and he's doing this, and you love this music and you've been playing it. And I've been playing Girl from Ipanema since I was about 13. I mean, you know, when we formed our first combo. There were three songs that we did in that combo: "Girl from Ipanema," "Mercy, Mercy, Mercy," and as soon as I say that, I forgot the last one. The work song was in there too, so I'll throw a work song in and act like that was the third one I was talking about. but those songs and "Girl from Ipanema," you know, I said, you know, because when I saw the reaction that the female teachers in the audience were having to this guy on stage and what all the females were reacting to with the song, I said, you know, I got to do this. This has got to
of course.
I want to be like that. I want to have that effect somewhere down the line.
Oh, my gosh. And look, I have to ask you along those lines. Was Miss Lily one of those ladies, the lovely Mrs. Kearns, and you have been married for such a long time, was she captivated? How did you and Lily meet? She was smitten
well,
by your
you know,
playing,
funny.
Maybe?
We went to college together, but the thing I tell people all the time, the reason I knew that Lily was the one was because our date nights were my gig nights, and our dates were breaks between sets. I'd be on stage for 45 minutes and she'd be listening and then I'd go out and we'd be able to sit and hang for 15 minutes, you know, before it was time for me to go back on stage. And so the two things about her that were always so cool was the fact that she knew the horn and the music was always gonna be there. And she knew that I cared about her and I cared about, you know, those things. And so those two things have been constants in my life over the last several years, and so it's been a big help for me, obviously. But any musician who's successful is successful because their spouse or mate is supportive and understands, because there are times, you know, I put all the time in my liner notes thank yous to Lily and to my daughter, Tiffany, because whatever time I'm devoting to music is taking away from time with them. And for them to be understanding and supportive and allow me to do that, is very important, and not to have a distraction, wondering and worrying about, you know, whether I should be doing this, whether I should be doing that, or feeling guilty about the fact that, that I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that. It's interesting. And my daughter's a saxophonist now. And,
that is so cool. Oh.
I tell you, and for us to be able to play duets and sit and do duets, I mean, you know, that's for me, that's hog heaven, man. I get a chance to sit and play duets with her and stuff. And when we did Quiet Nights, because she's a music major, when we did Quiet Nights, she actually was an extra ear for me in the studio as we were listening to things and as I was proofing things and we were talking about things. You know, she made some observations and made some comments, and I valued her comments and her observations, and a lot of things that came out on the finished product came out as a result of the two of us talking about things and talking about which take might have been the better take and what I did that should have been done differently or whatever, and just to be able to have that and to talk to her and share that was a very meaningful experience for me.
You taught her well. You told her early on when she expressed an interest in playing saxophone. You know, she learned by observation. She learned by example because of your work ethic. And then she was able to, what's the correct word, assimilate all of that knowledge into her fingers. So, and then into her head. So she was able to actually say back to you what you had been saying to her for years, which is pretty doggone cool.
Right. Well, she grew up on the East Coast Jazz Festival because Ronnie Wells, who was the person that started the East Coast Jazz Festival, was basically Tiffany's aunt. And Nasser Abadie, a great drummer, has a son, Kush. And Abadie and Tiffany were the babies of the East Coast Jazz Festival. They literally grew up on the East Coast Jazz Festival, and every year I would see them and talk about them growing. But what happened was they both had a chance to hear the music and see their parents interacting with the musicians and see their parents performing and things, and the music, you know, literally got into them, and it would have gotten into either one of them either way. But this particular situation was so great because the East Coast Jazz Festival was like a cruise that didn't move. It was a land cruise basically, and it was a, for musicians, it was a homecoming. We all knew once a year we were going to see each other and we were going to have a good hang, but we also knew that we were going to hear some really, really good music. And so
that's awesome.
So Tiffany had a chance to be around people like Clark Terry and Frank Foster and Ernie Andrews and others, and see them performing, but also see them as people, and it was a very interesting experience. And so all of the things that she got naturally, and some of the things she didn't realize she had gotten until it was time for her to call on certain things, certain skills, and so that was kind of the same thing that happened with me, except it happened with me through me sitting and listening to the music. And sitting and talking to different musicians as I was growing up. So that's an important part of it.
You know, this is going to be pretty fascinating. You have described your daughter's life growing up, everybody viewing her as a baby and then a toddler and then a sub-teen, teenager, and now she's a young woman. She could write a book. I hope she kept some notes, Ron.
Well, you know, it's, the funny thing about it was, when she got to college, people were talking about the different musicians and stuff, and she realized as she was listening to them describe all these people that all these were people that she knew and people that she had met and people, some of the people who had come through the house. And I'll never forget one time Buck Hill was at our house, and Buck is one of my mentors and very good friends, and Buck was bouncing Tiffany on his knee. And I had someone come in who didn't recognize Buck, didn't know Buck, and just assumed that was Tiffany's grandfather, because of the way she was reacting to Buck and the way Buck was bouncing her on his knee and everything. And when I told the person who it was, the person of course had heard of Buck Hill, but he had no idea that this very laid back, unassuming gentleman was the great Buck Hill, and he was bouncing my daughter on his knee. so she had those kinds of experiences, and I won't say took them for granted, but didn't realize what the true value of them was until later, when people started discussing different musicians and different things, and you know, she was able to say that she had heard and seen this firsthand. You know, very nonchalantly saying it, and there is, you know, you what?
It's so. Just when something is so much a part of your childhood, you begin to perceive this intense camaraderie, because once musicians get together in a setting like that year after year, it becomes extended family. So when you view it like that, you're thinking in terms of kin, not who that person is to the other world who doesn't know them the way you do. That's amazing.
Exactly. Mm. And that's precisely it.
Well, you know, I think that we should hear Quiet Nights, the title track, because we have to play a few songs, and this one embodies what folks are going to see when they come to Bethesda Blues and Jazz on the 26th, if that's okay with you,
yes.
Ron. Is that okay?
Go right ahead.
Okay. The amazing Ron Kearns is with us, my buddy, and this is the title track from his most recent CD, Quiet Nights, on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Mm-hmm.
This is the power of Ron Kearns. We've just heard 4.5 minutes of Quiet Nights, title track from his most recent project. And Griselda's in the chat room, and she said, you know, I can just see several couples outside, and they're dancing. And the camera zooms into the space of one specific couple. And I wrote back and said, yeah, and then they get a room. Ron, are you still there?
Yes, but don't blame me for that. I mean, they probably won't hear me that. But you know, it's kind of funny. If you've ever been to one of our shows, one of the things we always do, I always say to the audience, especially when we get ready to play a ballad, that you know, we're not responsible if they do that. And I warn them. I said, you know, the way these guys play and the passion they put into the music, if you're not careful, somebody's going to get in trouble. So make sure that you're with the person you're supposed to be with, because if not, you know, we're not responsible. So don't do it. And by the way, Griselda, I didn't ignore you. I just I was trying to get signed in so I could type in something to chat, but I was not successful in doing that. So I just want to let you know that I did see your comments and I did see all that stuff, and I just couldn't get in to comment.
No, she understands perfectly, and of course she said hello earlier. And, you know, I do have to tell you, Ron, in case you didn't see this, this is just so cool. And it's because of the different kinds of flavors that we have on the show. And no pressure or anything, but we've passed 102,000 listens for Hybrid Jazz. So that
wow.
will
Congrats.
Speak. Yes, thank you. That will hopefully translate into a number of people who will be at your Bethesda Blues and Jazz event. And number two, it will serve as a warning to those, because you just said it. My intention was to bring my camera so that I could show the flavor of the audience that night at BB&J. So make sure, everybody who's listening to the show now, that you indeed belong to the person with whom you sit at the table.
Or that they snatch the camera from you. No, I don't want them to stay away because of that. I just want them to cover their faces or snatch the camera from you. But listen, I want to point out also, anyone who is listening to this who wants to get a signed copy of Quiet Nights, if they come to the show and they point out that they heard about the show and heard about this by listening to your show, Hybrid Jazz, they will be able to get a signed CD at $10, which is, you know, obviously a nice little discount.
Great!
They can bring it. They can get it and bring it to the stage or bring it to where we are. And everybody except Mark, who's on the CD, will be there. And so they'll be able to get the autographs of all the people who are on there. And for those who would be interested in getting a copy, I will give them the same $10 price if they want to contact me through either Facebook or through my email. But they will have to pay for $2 for the mailing. So that would be a total of $12, which still once again comes out to be less than what it would be. But
yes.
I really enjoy it. I mean, I enjoy doing a lot of my recordings and doing things, and because it gives me a chance to work with the guys that I work with. But I don't know that I've had more fun on any project that I've recorded than I had on this one. The only one that was probably comparable as far as fun was the one we did live at Blues Alley in
Blues
Alley. You can hear when you hear that recording, you can hear the energy that was in that room that night, because it comes through the recording. But the recording was done so well, it's kind of hard to realize it was a recording until after we finish with a song and you get startled by hearing the applause of the crowd, because it sounds like a studio recording, the way Foxhaven recorded it and the job that John Miller, the engineer, did on that particular recording.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But that's
a beautiful. You just said something that's so integral to any live recording. First of all, the fun, and then the way it's produced. Because when you hear the clarity of that sound, it does. It's kind of shocking to hear the applause because you would think it was recorded.
Exactly. You're not. You know, you are somehow transported to a different place and then brought back to reality when you hear that.
Yes, I absolutely agree. That seemed like such a wonderful, spontaneous, and the teamwork. There's another word for it that I want to say, but when everybody is playing on the same team, and you truly enjoy one another's experiences on that stage, you really can feel it. You can't hide it.
No, you can't. And it goes the other way, too. You can immediately tell when you listen to certain groups live. You can immediately tell the guys that are on the date for the pay and for the night. One of my friends and homegirls, Renee Marie, mentioned one time we were in Atlanta, and she mentioned the fact that she insisted on being able to take her own groups with her to back her because of that we were just talking about, and because
yes.
When she got guys that were very good players, but they would immediately go into automatic and not do the arrangements that she had, and Renee has very intricate arrangements, and she has a certain style that she wants to do this. That's her signature style, and
yes.
And some of the better players who didn't know how to do it would just ruin the show by not knowing her little nuances and her little hits and things. And so all of that goes very well. And the guys that I've worked with, like with, we talk about Kent and Michael, we've been working together for 10 years or more, and knowing each other for at least 20 years, and there's a communication that goes in, and especially when I'm playing with Michael, I had a trumpet player by the name of Kenny Reed, who was one of the best trumpet players in the Washington area and played with everybody and did everything, and Kenny was non-sighted, but if you heard us playing together, you would never know because we started songs together and we ended songs together, and there was obviously no visual cue that was there. It was just kind of falling in each other. So I got spoiled by a very good trumpet player, and so
yeah.
When Kenny left, I replaced him with a trombone player, John Jensen, a great player, because I just didn't know of any other trumpet player that I was going to be able to work with that was going to be able to do that. And then one night at Westminster Presbyterian Church in D.C., where they have the Friday night jazz series, Michael came and sat in the group. I was playing with Buck Hill that particular night, and Michael came and sat in with us. And from that point on, I added him to the group. He was sometimes with us with John, and then it got to the point where we just went back to the old Blue Note front with trumpet and sax. And so Michael has been my go-to trumpet player since then.
Oh, Michael Thomas. I've been hearing about Michael for years because, well, quite frankly, I used to date a guy who's good friends with him, so I would hear all the time about how fabulous Michael Thomas is, and then I had a chance to interview him, actually, when I was on the other station where you were in Harford County, so it was real nice to be able to feel the passion of his playing. He both has a glorious time on that stage, and he takes the music very seriously. And that is that's a lethal combination. That's so beautiful because we need to do all that we can to support jazz in its current state and find ways to propel it forward, or else we're going to be sorry.
Well, if you've seen pictures of the jazz player and those kinds of things, and there's a particular look that you want to see a jazz player have, and you have this idea of what jazz players should be, And you look at Michael Thomas on stage, or you look at him as he's getting ready to go on stage, and look at him. I mean, he is the jazz guy. I mean,
yes,
you
know, yes, he is.
There is no question. I mean, you know, and everything about him brings the music forth, and it's just very, very interesting seeing that. And you can tell. I mean, as I said, that goes back into that communication thing where it all starts to come together, because he's like that because he really is living the music and embodying the music, and it is part of him. And so because it is part of him, it continues to come through him as he plays. And it's just as I always tell people, it's bad for me because I get so carried away listening to those guys, I forget I'm supposed to be doing something because I've got the best seat in the house sitting on stage listening to what they're doing. You know?
Oh,
and
I guess
myself,
so.
Wait a minute, man, you're – you're part of this. You got to play. It's your time.
Wait a minute. Whose gig is this?
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I would imagine, because you've got some formidable talent there. And I have to ask you these questions, a couple of things that people need to know about you. This quick reference for band directors that you have written, Ron, you know, it needs to get mentioned because this is in a lot of schools all over the country. You want to make sure folks know about this, please?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because after 30 years of teaching, you know, I say, well, maybe I actually have something I can say about this. I've done a lot of articles and things, and so there's a group, at the time it was called Music Educators National Conference, but it's now known as the National Association for Music Education. And so I, because I had been writing different articles for their satellite-like state groups, I decided to try to see if I could get a book published. And they have this very long process you've got to go through and all these different things that you have to go through in order for them to accept a book and have the book published. And they decided that they were going to make my book one of the books that they put out, and that is the organization for music educators throughout the world. And so I was very flattered by the fact that I made it through the process and that they actually published a book. But then when I started finding out how many colleges and universities were using it as a textbook for band directors, I was really, really humbled and satisfied. And so, yeah, finding out it was in two libraries really hit me. When I found out it was in the New York City Library, you know, I was like, wow, I'm in the New York City Library. And then when I found out that it was in the Harvard University Library, I said, wow, I'm in Harvard University.
You know? Oh my gosh!
So you know you have those flashes of ego trips that come by, and then as soon as the flash of the ego trip comes by, you know it's humbling. But the book came about because I was writing a journal to pass on to Tiffany because she's a music education major, and I was giving, you know, it was dad's advice to his daughter because I had a professor that had made us keep notebooks and things and made us do things. And my first year teaching, I went digging through my closet trying to find that notebook that Professor McGinnis had made us maintain. And everything he had made us do in class was that I needed to be successful as a band director that first year came out of that book. And so I said, well, wait a minute. You know, this was a compilation of different books. This wasn't a book that you could actually go to for this. And so I decided that I would just do that so that Tiffany would have that book. But then as I started actually going through it, I said, wait a minute, this is more than that. So people tell me that when they read it, they say, you know, this is like a narrative. It's as if you're actually sitting here talking about it. I said, well, the reason it's like that is because it was a dad telling his daughter, look, baby, this is what you're going to need to be successful. when you run into this wall, don't worry about it because you can take this wall down by doing this. And so it's a step-by-step manual, literally manual for what band directors have to do in order to survive. And so the people that read it at NAFNI and the people that read it that endorsed it for me were very very good educators, and they were very kind in the critiques that they wrote for the book. And so when people pick those up, and people in the music education programs at the different colleges and universities saw it, they did it. And had a gentleman who's the chairman at Vanderbilt, and as soon as he got the book to look at, he after going through the first few pages, decided that it was something that the students at his school needed to be exposed to, and so he immediately started giving it out and getting it in the hands of students that need to have that. And so, you know, being a band director is a major job, and people don't realize it. And it's always funny because someone says, "Oh, you just teach music," and you can tell people who have never been in bands or choirs, because if they say you just teach music, they have absolutely no idea,
no clue
what band directors and choral directors do, and music educators in general. And so once they get a chance to get exposed to all the different things that band directors have to do and that musicians have to do, they understand what's happening. And for a young teacher going out, it's overwhelming once they find out all the different things, because they've been prepared in most cases to be proficient in music. But there are so many other aspects to the job that they don't know about and that they aren't aware of. And a lot of things that I did, you know, Facebook is a beautiful thing, because I've got all these adults now who were my students, and they'll send me notes, private message, or they'll, you know, post something on my stage, on my page, that will state something that I did, something I said, and something that happened that inspired them that I had absolutely no idea it did, and it's just beautiful to be able to see and
see?
You know. Mm. And in most cases, it's not about the music. It's not what I did for them about the music. It's some life lesson that they got, or some little tidbit that they got from just my passion for music and passion for life, and how as a musician you can't really separate the passion for music and the passion for life. And that's the one thing that I learned in Africa at the University of East Africa, the fact that Africans didn't think of music as being something separate from life and something separate that students or children needed. I mean, every African child had to learn music because music was their way of communication. It was their way of recording history. It was their way of showing emotion. And it was in their opinion what made man complete. And I use man in the editorial man.
Yes.
And learning that at the formative age that I was there carried over into everything else that I did, and it caused me to realize that as a music educator and as a musician, I'm doing the same thing. A music educator, I'm simply putting it in words. I'm showing people the theoretical side, but as a musician, I'm showing them practically what's going on, and I'm touching them with my music, or I'm letting them know, okay, leave that care that you had behind. You know, just take this as your little oasis. Take this time that you're listening to this song or to these songs or this set. Take this time and let it remove all cares from you. Escape. Go to that special place that we all want to go to, and let my music take you there. And just allow yourself to be swept away for this moment, because you don't know if you're going to have another moment like this. So take advantage of this.
That's right. That's right. 2013 really brought that home to us, and actually 2012
yes.
as well. But last year was absolutely an urgent communication from heaven that we better get our acts together and do what we need to do, because tomorrow is not promised. You were just saying a little while ago, Ron, about maybe the ego setting in because of the successes that you've had, but you know above most people that you are going to be approached when you leave this earth by the same sort of heavenly messenger who says, do you think that you've done what your gift permitted you to do? Did you do everything that you could to make sure that, and here's what we're going to say in relative closing to this, if I can help somebody out, run? Did you help all that you could? And you're going to be able to say, yes, I did.
I hope so.
So there.
I really hope so.
Well, you are in a myriad of ways you have done that. It's really a beautiful thing to see as your friend, people paying such respect to you on Facebook and you getting these accolades through the years. It's just really wonderful. And I know that when you were on the show, this has gone back now over a year or so, you were talking about this particular song, If I Can Help Somebody, and I know it means a lot to you, so I thought we could play it in closing, if that's okay.
Great, great, yes,
yeah.
Perfect.
Well,
thank you so much.
Once again, thank you, BethesdaBluesJazz.com. That's where you need to go to purchase your tickets for this Sunday show, January the 26th. It's going to be one of those pivotal nights of your life where you're going to hear jazz and then some. And of course, you know I'll see you there, Ron.
Yes, thank you. Looking forward to
talking to you some more, and I'll see you along the campaign trail.
Sounds good.
Take care
of yourself.
You all too, right. Ron. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Ron Kearns as our guest, and this is one of those songs, I'm telling you, just get ready, If I Can Help Somebody on Hybrid Jazz. This is Hybrid Jazz.
night, ever light of winds, light as the faintest mist, soft flutter of a I know I can feel a kiss before we say a word, caught in a breathless very start. In a touch, you are here. I return your kiss to you. feather light of winds, light as the faintest mist, soft flutter of a wing. You come near, and you are. are here, I return, yes, your kiss to you, to touch. Your touch, your face, your kiss, your kiss.
Oh, I forgot about that last part right there. Oh, my gosh. Now, you might not be familiar with that voice because that's a gentleman who is not necessarily known to sing first as a primary example of his career. He's a noted drummer who has played with extraordinary talent because he is extraordinary. And then one day, back years ago, Peggy Lee heard him sing and went, "Just a second, what? What?" And she made Grady Tate sing from then on out. And Kenny Barron, when Kenny was on the show a year or so ago, gosh, that was so nice. Kenny was talking about The Traveler from 2008, and that's one of the songs from it. Anne Hampton Calloway and Gretchen Parlato are on this project as well, but Kenny just loves Grady Tate's voice, and he thought it would be so wonderful if one of Kenny's songs, Un Viejo, which is essentially a kiss, got covered by Grady, and he just does such a phenomenal job. So, Ron, if you are still listening, I think that you are, that is sort of another nod from Portugal that alludes to the fact that you're going to be at Bethesda Blues and Jazz on the 26th. Woo, that is such sweet stuff. Also on this album is Kiyoshi Kitagawa, just so magnificent on bass, Lionel Lukey on guitar, Francisco Mela on drums, and Steve Wilson doing his sax from time to time. Just love it. We heard, too, Weather Report from 1974. Oh, can you just dive into that? Oh, my gosh. I love this fifth album, Mysterious Traveler. Just such a wondrous journey to different places around the world. I'll never forget what Gerald Veasley said about Joe Zawinul. He said that no matter what happened to Joe, Joe would look on the bright side of things. And if you remember, if you were listening to this show, Gerald said that Joe was facing the loss of his home due to fires in California, going back a number of years now. And Joe said, "Well, you know what? If that happens, then I can just start all over again in New York." Wow. So Mr. Sunshine just did this track called Jungle Book, and you just felt the forest and little springs of water popping up here and there and the sounds of animals playing together and just joy in the air. There's just a beautiful little excursion into wherever your mind takes you. Joe wrote that song, of course, Wayne Shorter, Ishmael Wilburn. This was the first time that he got to play on a Weather Report album, and also Dom Orm Romeo, and it was the end of the run for Miroslav Vitoš. Alfonso Johnson replaced him later on with Weather Report. This was such a beloved series of work, this Mysterious Traveler, that the Downbeat Readers poll chose that as their favorite album for the year, 1974. Wonderful stuff. And Ron Kearns, speaking of wonderful stuff, if I can help somebody, you got to pick up the Quiet Nights CD. Please promise me that you will. Ron Kearns, KEARNS.com, has the way to do it. And you heard what Ron had to say. If you go to his website and you mention that you heard us play tracks and you heard Ron doing the interview on the show, and then if you go to Bethesda Blues and Jazz and you say, look, I heard you on Hybrid Jazz, he will give you a discount on the CD, which I think is a wonderful deal. So I'll make sure that I say that a lot before now and January 26th. We are going to play some more tracks here, and I told you on Facebook that we were going to play present and past and a little delving into the future. Well, we're going to trip back in a time to 1960, if you don't mind. I was thinking about the kind of memories and music that Ron Kearns would like, because whenever a guest is going to be on the show, I think, all right, what can I do to enhance the experience for those who might be listening because of the guest? And I thought, you know, I think Hank Mobley might be a good choice. We heard Space Station earlier from Art Farmer and Benny Golson and Company. This is Soul Station on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Woohoo! Thank you. It's Hybrid Jazz.
Thank you. and I just have to say, won't take long to tell you how I feel. I felt this way the first time I looked into your eyes. I knew it was love, knew you were the only one for me. From now until forever, with you I want to be. With every night we'll start our life together. So just give me your hand for now and forever, and I give you my heart forever and more, for the rest of our days, for now and forever with you. To the future and I see the two of us together. No matter what may come our way, we will be standing side by side to see it through. Now until forever, with you I want to be with him. So just give me your hand forever, and I give you my heart forever and more, for the rest of our days, for now and forever. So just give me your hand, for now and forever, and I give you my heart forever and more, for the rest of our days, for now and forever, you.
Happy birthday, Slim Man. Woohoo! Had to play that song. It's a favorite for a few of us who love Mr. Tim. We just love him so much. And when, his fans heard Thousand Miles Away, this is going back now a little bit, a few years, this song just stood out. And it was fascinating to us because all the tracks were great on the CD, but that ended the album, and it was a live track, as you just heard. So he told me at that time, well, there's method to my madness here, always. I'm going to include that track as a precursor to Slim Man Live, which will come out next year. So truth of the matter is, he was true to his word. So you can hear that song For Now and Forever, both on Thousand Miles Away and Slim Man Live. Beautiful. If you are a member of the Email Blast or know Slim on Facebook, or Slim Manicotti, as he is called there, you will see that he wrote something quite beautiful and poignant, actually. He suggested that maybe, and of course his tongue was firmly in cheek, I think, that maybe when we do marriage vows, it shouldn't be I do, but I'll try. It broke my heart. It broke Griselda's heart, too. She's in the chat room. We were getting a little weepy because it just took on this regretful and or sad tone. Always he's Mr. Happy when he writes these things, but there was something there that suggested he was pondering life more thoughtfully than usual. Slim will be at the View Grill and Bar in Indian Wells, California, which is a part of Palm Springs, through February. There's a good possibility that he might stay there. And indeed, I found out from Griselda that Slim will be on GHP Radio next week. Woohoo! So maybe you'll get the truth pulled out of him. Come here, you. Pull it out of him. Hopefully he'll stay where he belongs, coughing, in California. Nashville was good for a while, true, but now he needs to find his foothold and get those acting jobs that we know he can get right alongside of George Clooney. See where I'm going with this? Yeah. Happy birthday, Slim, once again. Mm-hmm. View, V-U-E, Grill and Bar in Indian Wells, California, near Palm Springs. We heard Slim's buddy, Elliot Levine, based in the D.C. area, and Elliot's Urban Groove was backing him up from Live Plus 7 from 2008. Elliot is one of the more phenomenal keyboardists in this region, ask Heatwave, because he's been touring with them for a few years now. Just amazing. He redid With Love the Isley Brothers, For the Love of You, from Live Plus 7. The recorded tracks, as a matter of fact, I have the information right here because I love to give these local folks props. You know what I mean? Let's see. For the recorded tracks, it was Elliot on piano, my friend Ernest Abdul Rahim on bass, one of the best there is. Seriously. I love me some Pitbull. Mo Teal on drums, James Carney on percussion. The live tracks were recorded at Club 347, which is one of the places that we go in Baltimore with some frequency. And we heard, too, from Hank Mobley, 1960, Soul Station on Blue Note. The quartet is composed of his former band leader in Jazz Messengers, Art Blakey, and also what would be his mates alongside Miles, Wynton Kelly and Paul Chambers. Oh, it was deliriously grand. Hank Mobley, considered one of the more underrated musicians of the bop era. He was understated on that saxophone. Not glitzy, just got the job done, and your ears just got full of that sound that won't let go. Passed away in 1986, and we wanted to feature something from one of the greats that was, since we have guested a current great, Ron Kearns, on the show. So there, Ron, if you're still listening, yes, a great. Let's play two songs now to finish her up here on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Birthday Gal coming up, but first, I want to play a track from what All About Jazz considers the absolute pinnacle of Chris Standring's career. Man, I read the review this morning. This is going back now, 2010, but they had some pretty strong praise for this gentleman who was on the show not that long ago. I give you Blue Bolero on Hyper Jazz.
Thank you. I've lost the use of my heart, but I'm still alive, still looking for the light, the endless pool on the other side. It's the wild, wild west. I'm doing my best.
Turn it all around.
for joining us on Hybrid Jazz. Happy birthday, Sade, Soldier of Love from 2010. Phew! Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Tuesday with Tom Reyes talking about a recovery effort in the Philippines, how we can help our brothers and sisters, and Tracy Hamlin next Thursday on Hybrid Jazz. God bless everyone who tuned in today or who will. And we'll see you next Tuesday. Thanks to Ron Kearns as well. Have a good one.